You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 467. One thing, actually, right off the bat, I'm just going to address this. Let's say who's here first. First of all, we are here with Hallie Bullet. Hallie Bullet, what's happening in the world of HB? What's going on? What's new? What's kicking? How you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. I'm looking at my pumpkin, which I carved yesterday. I'm feeling pretty good, feeling pretty Halloween-y.
What kind of face? Do you give it the classic scare, something amusing, or a different expression? What kind of face?
I mean, this is the most classic pumpkin face you could possibly. I mean, this is, yeah, I stuck to the basics. I'm not much of a visual artist, if you will. I'm good at the performing arts. The visual arts are not my thing. So I went with the basics.
Hallie Bullet, it's 2019, and in 2019, everything is postmodern, you know, self-referential, meta. Have we overlooked the classic to our detriment as a society?
I like basic shit, I gotta say. I'll tell you what's the most impressive about this pumpkin, though, is just its sheer size. I went to this apple picking farm with my family, and then you could also just run around a field and like grab a bunch of pumpkins, and I just grabbed the most massive pumpkin. Like my arms were like aching, like just walking through the field and like dragging this thing back to where I had to pay for it, but it was totally worth it. I have an absolutely gigantic jack-o'-lantern now.
There's no such thing as a pumpkin that's too big. I've never seen a pumpkin and said that pumpkin's too big. You know, good choice. Adam, what's your pumpkin skills at right now? How many have you carved? How many have you picked from the patch? And are you waiting for the arrival of the great pumpkin yourself?
John, I carved two pumpkins literally an hour ago.
Fantastic. Yes.
Which is to say, we were sitting there after dinner, and we were about to put the kids to bed, and then we're like, oh shit, Halloween is in like 2 days. We need to carve these. So kept the kids up a little bit, brought the pumpkins out. The thing that I've learned to do, and this is really where you have to embrace like the outsider art potential of your children, is don't just carve a pumpkin face for them in the traditional sense. What you do is basically you give the kid a marker and you say like draw whatever you want on this pumpkin and I will carve it. And the faces that the kids make are horrifying. And right, like in the like they seem like they were designed by someone that is not all there. And it's mainly because the children don't have great motor skills, especially when they're trying to write on a pumpkin with a dry erase marker. So they come up with this completely bonkers crap that you would not think to carve into a pumpkin on your own. And then you just kind of do your best to make these like bizarre squiggles that they've done into the actual face of the pumpkin. And it always comes out way weirder than whatever I was going to come up with on my own. And I don't want to say the kids are that creative. I just think they can't draw, but it has the same, it's the same end result.
Adam, are you taking pumpkin carving to daring and perhaps fearful new places?
Oh yeah, John, I'm revolutionizing the whole art. Can I talk about apple picking right now? Because oh my God, we went a week ago and the couple baskets of apples that we pulled out of the farm have like, it is breaking my heart that they're almost gone. Like they're insanely good. And it makes like supermarket apples taste like just, you know, mushy
like
garbage.
Garbage.
It's making me sad that they are going away. So
we waited too long to go apple picking. My family went this last weekend and there were no apples left. And it was like one of the most comical things I've ever experienced because it was just like all these families wandering around this apple orchard and there were no apples. like, and then because I've still managed to hold on to a little bit of agility in my middle age, I ended up like scaling to the top of a tree where there were like still some apples left because nobody had been able to get to them. And I'm just like throwing down apples from the top of this tree to my family. So I was like the hero. I was the hero. I saved the day. It was amazing.
Yeah. It is not something that I had done with my kids before. Again, mainly because like I'm not convinced that they have enough motor skills to do anything competently. But but like now that I've done it, it's really like all I want to do. Because it's they're almost gone. It's breaking my heart. They're almost gone. John, let's talk about apples from now on instead of
whatever. All right. I'll blow your mind right now. My father has 40 or so apple trees, and I have picked apples many, many, many times, and cherries, and pears. So there you go.
Oh, you're a produce scion, though, right? Like, that's not fair.
Listen, when you're out there picking apples in the summer, and the wasps are biting at you, and the crows are picking at you, you guys might have a different. I'm a real apple picker, unlike you two. Listen, so we're gonna do record collecting today, and the only reason we're gonna do record collecting is I'm doing it under the guise. I told Adam and Hallie that we don't have that much news, but actually there's plenty of news. But I had a pretty adventurous record collecting past couple of months, and so that's why we're gonna do record collecting today. Record collecting, in case you don't know, is the feature where we talk about cool records that we recently got, and I've gotten three pretty cool recent records. Cool item number one is I saw Tegan and Sarah on, was it Saturday? I saw Tegan and Sarah on Saturday, and they are promoting their new album, Hey, I'm Just Like You. And for some reason, the new album actually really didn't get that great reviews, but more so it didn't get reviews, basically. It kind of came and went in a blip, and then maybe that's because it was, you know, positioned along with their album, and maybe that's because their book, and also because it was re-recording of songs that they wrote before they actually released their first official songs. And the album is fantastic. Like, if you like The Con, it is halfway between The Con and their best pop stuff. And it is – I'm surprised this record – like there's one song called Runaway. I don't know how that song was in the huge hit. It is an awesome track. But the point being is if you buy it from them at the tour, the CDs and the records are signed. So that's always – like it is really fun to get tour-only merch, especially when it's a CD or a record. So I love when bands do that. So Tegan and Sarah, if you're a fan – get that stuff. They're on tour right now, and there's a lot of cool. The album's great. It's great. I would say it's the best album since The Con, or maybe second best after Closer, which was a great album. After that, Hallie and Adam, I don't know if you guys really do the Discogs thing. I was complaining about Discogs a couple of months ago because I said, oh, I used to be able to get Damned records for $1. Now they're all $15 to $20 on Discogs. But the other side of Discogs is that you can get really, really rare stuff. But the other flip side is that I feel that much like eBay, Discogs is getting a little shadier. Because on Discogs, somebody posted a really rare Rolling Stones promo version of their album, A Bigger Bang, which has a different track listing and slightly different mixes. He posted it for like $7. So I bought it within minutes of it being posted online. In the mail, it's just a normal version of the record. It's not the rare version. So I'm like, oh, I got busted. Then another guy posted a really rare version of a Melvins album. It's the handmade version that has, like, is handmade by the band and signed for a really cheap price. I bought that. I get that in the mail. It's just a normal version of the album. Then I've got three what I would say white whales in my collection right now. Country Mike's Greatest Hits, which is the Beastie Boys Country Western record. The World in Front's very first single, and the Melvins live vinyl version of their box set, which is an amazing set. So I really only have one white whale left. And my other one was the rare Beastie Boys custom mix albums. But I only have one white whale left. And that's in the mid-90s, Guar self-released 7 cassettes, and they're basically all experimental and throwaway tracks. So the music actually isn't even that good. But they're extremely rare, and they're the only officially released Guar thing that I don't have. And I could have bought them about 15 years ago for $100 of all of them. I passed on it because, you know, 15 years ago, $100 was more to me then than it is now. And I've regretted it every day since for the past 15 years. And on Discogs, a guy posted the entire set for $24. And I snapped it up right away. And then about 3 days later, he sent me an email. He goes, oh, I made a mistake. I don't actually have all 7 of them. I only have 1 of them. But I've got other rare Guar stuff. And I'm like, well, what do you have? He's like, I've got a poster given to me by Dave Brocky. And he's like, I can give you that instead. I said, well, all right, can you give me the poster and the cassette? And he said, fine. And so I get it in the mail. There's no cassette there. However, there is this crazy Guar poster from 19. It's a Subway poster. It's gigantic. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. It's like 5 feet by like 4 feet. It's from the Scum Dogs of the Universe. It's really – I'm probably going to try to frame it, but it'd probably be insane expensive to frame. But it's like a promo poster to sell records that they would put in the Subway – in 1992, which is crazy. So it's awesome. And I don't know if you two have had experienced this, but Discogs is becoming a little bit more of a Wild West, which I'm not a huge fan of that, but sometimes it bounces in your direction. But here is the third and final thing. And I shouldn't be talking about it because I might jinx myself. Adam White, can you please explain to the listeners the difference between mono and stereo?
Like, really? Like the split channels, the left-right channels on things, as opposed to everything just being recorded in one mix that doesn't... I'm the worst person to explain this, but I feel like everyone knows what this is.
Okay, well, it's important that we explain it because we're going to have to come panel. So there's mono, which is all the music, all the guitars, all the vocals, all everything, they're both in the left and the right speakers. There's no separation.
Yeah, they're being
stereo,
equal. Yeah.
Stereo is there's different sonic tracks, and so there might be like bass in one speaker, guitar in another, or echo from the guitar in one speaker and the live guitar in the other, something like that. So that's stereo. And so there's what's called, as to mono, there's called dedicated mono mixes and fold-down mono mixes. A fold-down mono mix is where they just take the stereo version and just put both sonic tracks on one channel, and so it's essentially the same as a stereo, except for both instruments come out of the same channel. Whereas the stereo ones that come out with different channels. Then there's what's called dedicated mono mixes. And that's where the actual mix of the mono record is different than the mix than the stereo record. The two most famous groups that do this were the Beatles and the Beach Boys. The Beatles famously had different mono mixes, I think, for Sergeant Pepper is the most famous one. So if you listen to the original Sergeant Pepper on mono, it sounds way different. Well, not way different, but significantly different than the stereo version. For example, some of the vocal tracks are different. On the mono version, there's horns that there aren't in the stereo version. And there's other differences, too. Now, it still sounds kind of the same record, but if you're a maniac like myself and other record collectors, they sound different.
And they reissued all that the Beatles mono stuff not too long ago, right? Like, those mixes all kind of came out.
Right, and actually, they recently released the new stereo mix, which is the mono mixed in the stereo to make it even more complicated.
Mm.
A band that had dedicated mono mixes for a little while, not as much as the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, John's favorite band. There is the Rolling Stones stopped doing dedicated and mono mixes around with Satanic Majesty's Request. So starting with Beggar's Banquet, they did have a few mono mixes, but those were just fold downs of the stereo. Except there's a very rare promo version of Sticky Fingers, arguably Stone's greatest album ever. A promo mix, only one press, that has some slightly different mono mixes than the stereo version or the mono fold-down mix. So it is an extremely rare thing. I've only ever seen one in person myself once before when I was in the Netherlands at the record convention, and literally the world's biggest Rolling Stones collector had it not even for sale, just on display behind him. And I mean, I never even considered this a white whale because I never thought I would have any chance ever to get it. I'm not going to spend $6,000 on a record, you know. And if you want it, if you can find it, that's what it costs. I'm not spending $6,000 on a record. On Discogs, one popped up, and I'm not going to say for how much, but not even 1/20th, not even 1/30th of the going rate. And the guy put on it, rare mono version has promo only sticker, and I bought it like that within like a minute, and I haven't gotten it yet. And I hope I'm not jinxing myself, but I'm thrilled. Adam and Hallie, will I get the Holy Grail of Rolling Stone collectibles? Like, this is the bad boy, you know what I mean? What will I get in the mail? Because I've had three bounce backs in a row on Discogs between Guar, between Melvins, and the other Rolling Stones. Is this too good to be true? Because the thing with record collecting is if it's too good to be true, it probably is, but sometimes it isn't. You know what I'm saying? So, who knows? Who knows? Who knows?
I mean, I want you to get this so bad. I'm like rooting for you all the way, but it really, from everything you've said, I don't know what you're getting in the mail. I don't. It really does seem too good to be true. I don't know what's going to arrive on your doorstep.
We'll see. I don't know. I mean, this is going to be an adventure. I mean, this is the kind of record that like dudes that go to record convention and drop like 20 grand. Like that's who gets this, you know? And I didn't spend anywhere near that, you know, anywhere near that. So I don't know what I'm going to get.
Does it happen occasionally that someone's selling something that they just kind of don't know what they have? I wouldn't imagine because then I would think they wouldn't be selling it on Discogs. They'd be selling it on like eBay or something. You know, it'd be someone that some old person that just doesn't realize what they're sitting on.
You are correct, except for one time I got the Integrity demo cassette, which was $300. I got it for $16 just because some guy had a beef against Integrity, and he made the records collector seller mistake is that if you don't like something, then you think it's not worth anything. So he sold it for $16, and I snapped it up like that. However, the guy that posted it seemed to be a fan and knew what he was talking about. So we'll see. We'll see.
John, I hope you get this record. But what if you do, though? Like, what if you have all your white whales? Like, are you done?
Well, I'm not done record. I mean, I essentially was done on my white whales, except for the Guar cassettes. And I thought it might be kind of a bummer, but actually it's kind of, like, thrilling. It's like, wow, I've got these amazingly cool records, you know, and I mean, I still buy lots of records, you know, but like it also kind of to a degree makes record collecting a little bit more fun, I guess, because it's like you always win because you get something cool, you know, like you don't have that thirst, that hunger. But on the other hand, you don't have the thirst and you don't have the hunger. The hunt is over, like Ahab drowning himself at sea, you know. So I don't know, man. I hope I get it, though. We'll see.
Here's hoping, John. I don't know if I have anything as dramatic or interesting as that to bring into the conversation. So I'm wondering if I should just like let your thing ride. I mean, my latest acquisition of note here is that I give enough free press to Mint Records that they sent me a test pressing of the new Woolworm record, and I'm, you know, it sits among the handful of weird test pressings that labels have sent me over the years that I have. This one I'm really stoked about because it's a good record. What is the other one that I have for whatever reason? I have a Planes Mistaken for Stars test pressing that's here. No, I like that band. They're cool, but like they're certainly not one of my favorites. But so it's one of those ones where like, hey, if you're a Punk News podcast listener and you want to give me hundreds of dollars for a Planes Mistaken for Stars test pressing, I'll totally fold and give that to you. But you know what I found in a record store the other day, John? And I'm sure you have this because it's lovely. I just never managed to see a copy in real life. Is a copy of Davidstown.
Oh yeah, I had that.
It's so nice. And I was just sitting there poring over the track listing on it. No, I guess if anyone does not remember what that was, back in 2011 when David Comes to Life came out, the Fucked Up record, they went and because Fucked Up is nothing if not like whimsical in the John Gentile sense of spending an inordinate amount of time on things that aren't really necessary. They went and they recorded a whole record of entirely fictional bands that are all bands that are set in the fictitious UK town, which is also the setting for the narrative of David Comes to Life. So it's sort of like, it's world building. Like it's the Silmarillion to the Lord of the Rings that is the rest of the Fucked Up catalog. So and I always, like, when it came out, I was just like, oh, this is just full of goofy, weird power pop songs. And I didn't think too much about it. But like a ton of the people that record vocals on here are people in bands that I regularly follow nowadays. And just it didn't clue into me at the time that it was them on there. So Daniel Romano from Attack and Black and Ancient Shapes, he has a track on there. Simone Schmidt, who she records solo as an alt-country project called Fiverr, but she also plays in a kind of cosmic-y band out of Toronto called The Highest Order. She's on there. AC Newman from The New Pornographers sings one of the songs, and it does not sound like him at all unless you really clue in that it's him, because he's just like awash in vocal effects. It's way more fun than I recall it being. So I'm happy to own a copy of that. But John, that's no way whale. You can just go buy that in a store.
Well, listen, Adam, it's not a competition. It's a camaraderie. You know what I'm saying? Davidstown, my old man's a ginger. Damien Abraham doing Boot Boy Oi. Young Gov in his classic weirdo sense doing Gary Glitter style power pop. Will you go for a curry with me? Fantastic record, Adam. Good choice.
Nice.
Yeah. So, anyways, those are things I now own. But yeah, that's what I want to talk about. What about you, Hallie? Anything come across your plate?
Yeah, all my algorithms across my various like music platforms that I like listen to stuff on. Like I kept getting every algorithm kept pushing this indie pop band, the Generationals, on me until it finally just worked. I just was completely brainwashed into really loving this band. So I got like their newer release, which is called Reader as Detective, on this like beautiful clear vinyl with this paint. It almost looks like there's like a paint. It's like a clear and pink fried egg. It's gorgeous. And then because I like their older record Hezza so much, I just, while I was at it, I went and ordered that on clear vinyl, and they're very pretty and they're great, like new wavy, like indie pop, good like dance songs. I'm into it.
Very cool.
Very cool. Well, let's get into the mailbag here. You can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. This is from Strats, and here's what Strats has to say. John complaining about his love life is hilarious. I love his misery. Just kidding. You guys should do a dating advice episode every so often. I feel like your advice is measured but practical. Also, have you heard of the Darts? They're a garage rock band, and I think Adam would love them as he loves grimy retro music. From Strats.
I have not heard of the Darts in particular, but I should totally go check out the Darts. The internet tells me that the Darts were from Brighton in 1976, if that's the Darts we're talking about. So I'll go check that out. We are, by the way, the worst people to give dating advice to anyone. I mean, like, not just because I think that we'd probably be bad at it, but like both Tom and I have been married for, like, not to each other, but like to at least a decade. And I mean, like, and like my wife and I just celebrated 20 years since our first date, which means I have like zero experience dating other humans. So I can't imagine that. I mean, Tom, I imagine, was a ladies' man back in the day, but that was like back in the 40s where, you know, everyone was, there were like the society was just different at the time, right? And
I think I would give great dating advice. But it would be all like, it would be all, because I haven't been married that long, but it would all be like, do as I say, not as I did, because I made like every mistake. All my dating advice would just be like, please, everyone, just learn from my mistakes.
Well, you see, that's so like, you should be doing this. I mean, maybe you could just like give John advice and the rest of us can sit down. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad that our writer, our reader, listener, whatever his name is, enjoyed John's tale of strange dating woe, because it was super problematic and could have went off the rails at any given moment, and I just wanted that story to end when he was telling.
Well, we handled it quite maturely. Well, you and I did. Maybe Tom did it, but you and I did.
Yeah, but see, I didn't know where you were going with it, so I'm just thinking that, like, oh, I don't want to have to tank this whole episode because John's going to say something really bad. But it didn't happen. So,
you know. I wonder if Adam's the new Ricky, and that, you know, Adam gets a little shooken up when we get towards certain areas. You know what I mean?
I didn't know where you were going with it, John. You could have went somewhere weird. We got limits. We got limits.
And this is from Steve, and here's what Steve says. What is your process for determining what songs you'll play on the podcast? I like listening to new songs that you guys play. Is there any sort of selective measures that you use when determining what songs you're going to play? Does it have to be a song no one knows, or can it be a well-known song? Keep it up, from Steve.
So it used to be we would go ask the artists if we could play the song, and then they would give us like verbal permission or written permission in an email or something like that, and then we would play it. These days, I'm paying for a SOCAN license because we are technically on Canadian soil here, which is like a it's like a license from like say like ASCAP or BMI or something like that. So it pays some money into the artist's rights thing. So we're using that as a shield. So hopefully no one that we're playing will sue us. Now, John flirts with disaster all the time because he keeps playing like the Rolling Stones on here as opposed to, you know, like little indie bands that are probably not going to try to sue us. So we'll see how it goes. But as far as the actual choice of the songs, there's no discussion about it beforehand. I usually panic and start looking at iTunes 2 minutes before the show to figure out what's been stuck in my head recently that I can talk about for 30 seconds. But, John, you keep throwing these enormous, you know, screwball dub songs and stuff like that into the mix. So you probably think about it more than I do.
Listen, if we haven't been popped yet, then we're not going to get popped. You know, that's always how it works. You know, if you're a drug dealer and you haven't been caught yet, then you're not going to get caught. I mean, that's how it works. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. Who's going to play a song? Speaking of playing songs.
All right.
I can play a song.
No, good. Do it.
No, Adam, go ahead.
No, I was just trying to fill space in which I was going to panic and go look at iTunes. So if you have a song.
I don't know if you guys talked about this last week, but the Screaming Females put out this like B-side and like singles kind of rarities compilation. It just came out. And so, yeah, I'm not playing something new. There's like a great old single of theirs on this collection that I hadn't listened to in a long time. And I was like so delighted to hear it again. And it's, you know, really poppy. I don't think anyone really thinks of them as a particularly poppy band anymore. But some of their early stuff really is sort of just delightfully poppy. And they very rarely play that stuff live. So, yeah, I just like love this little song. It's called I Do by Screaming Females. And yeah, this is like, you know, I think it was a single or like a early like 7-inch single or something. So this is the first time you can get it as part of like a bigger thing.
and that was the Screaming Females doing I Do. Hallie Bullet, the Screaming Females. Greatest band or greatest band ever?
I mean, they're like totally incredible. I mean, I will say, like, they're just one of the, we were just talking about this because we were saying this about Downtown Boys. There are just certain bands though, just like, I would never, ever, ever turn down an opportunity to see them live, and that's Screaming Females, but whatever. Everybody knows that. Yeah, they're amazing. Completely amazing.
Are they getting their due? Should they be more famous, or do you think that they're famous enough and then they're happy with that? Should they be rich is what I'm saying.
No, I think they're just at the right place, right?
Fair enough. Fair. I mean, it's true, because the more famous you get, the more meddling there is. You know what I mean? And I hate for the Screaming Females to get meddled with. If they're happy, I'm happy. You know what I'm saying?
I think they've got to be happy. I mean, it's pretty. I mean, it's wonderful music and like appealing to a lot of people, but it's definitely weird. I mean, her voice is so amazingly crazy. You know, I think if they were like trying to get rich, I think they would be making different artistic choices that would make them appeal to like an even broader amount of people. Like, I think they're just right exactly where they should and need to be.
Fantastic band. And Adam refused to put them on his best of 2018 list, for which I will never forgive him. Let's get into this week's news.
You just said they downtown shouldn't be rich.
So a bunch of over 170 bands have banded together to protest. Well, I don't know if protest is the right word. Boycott Amazon events. The reason they're boycotting Amazon events is because Amazon, quote, continues to provide the technical backbone for ICE's human rights abuses. Basically, Amazon works with ICE and have provided technology and information to ICE to, I guess, help ICE continue finding people and arresting them and doing that kind of a thing. Bands that have signed the boycott include Downtown Boys, Jeff Rosenstock, Ted Leo, Guy Pachoto, Fugazi, Deerhoof Drill, Katie Alice Greer of Priests, Pink Wash, and a whole bunch more. Some punk bands, some bands that aren't, quote, punk. So importantly, some of the bands that have signed it actually were offered the chance to play Amazon events and turned it down. I think this is good, and I respect any artist that takes a stand on pretty much anything. I was dismayed in the comments section. People were like, well, Amazon doesn't care about you, or like, oh, good job. Well, it's like, well, at least they're doing something, you know. At least they're using their art to make a stand and, you know, project some sort of a message. I thought this was great. I think Amazon is horrible, and I support anybody kicking down against Jeff Bezos or kicking up against Jeff Bezos.
Wait, what? You're going to make us sad?
Express yourself, and then I'll make you sad too.
Okay. Well, this is not like a loaded question. I don't have like a super strong like opinion about this, but it seemed, you know, when I looked, it seemed like you could still sort of get all of these artists' music on Amazon. You could still, you know. So I wanted to ask you guys if you think this is like effective. There was like a part of me that thought, you know, I'm with you, John. I think it's great. I think anytime that people want to stand up for what they believe in and try to unite as like a community of artists, I'm totally into it. So I'm in no way like putting this down, but I wanted to ask you guys, like, how effective do you think this is? Because it seems like they were or are like boycotting such a very specific thing
true.
Through Amazon and not really doing any kind of all out boycott of business with Amazon, which to me would be the thing that would actually have like a greater impact, you know?
So you're asking me, do I think this will have a greater impact as a whole?
Yeah. Or like, I don't know. It's like, I'm not trying to call anybody out or say like, oh, it's so hypocritical, but like, do you think it's meaningful to boycott just specifically these festivals if like your music is still very much entrenched in Amazon in general? You know what I mean?
I do. A good question. And my answer would be is I hope so. And here's why. I mean, Amazon is terrible if you ask me. Like, Amazon has put so many local businesses out of business. Amazon has distinctly decreased the quality of American products, you know, products that you can get as an American consumer. And further, the backbone of their products are made, you know, in China in Haiti, in places where working conditions are deplorable. That's where most Amazon products come from. So Amazon's horrible. I think they're terrible. I think that they distinctly are worsening human American quality of life for sure. Also, no, as we said last week, no one needs $80 billion. I mean, like after maybe $5 billion, it's just grotesque. You know, I'd like $1 billion, sure. I'd like $2 billion. That'd be great. You know, I mean, that's a lot of money. But after a while, it's like you're just sick. You know, you could save 1 million people's lives with your money, but you're just hoarding it. That's all you're doing. Anyways, the point being is this making a difference? Here's my hope, Hallie. I'm a firm believer in voting with your dollar. I hope and I believe that works. I don't know that it works. And honestly, I'm not sure that it does work because a lot of companies do horrible things and people say they're going to vote with their dollar, but the company's still there. What I'm hoping is things like this don't damage Amazon directly, but it maybe influences younger people and people like us that Amazon is not a cool company, that they're pretty bad. So maybe you go somewhere else. So I'm hoping just the statement in of itself influences how people vote with their dollar. I don't think what's going to happen is everyone's going to cross their arm and Amazon will say, okay, we give up. We'll give you what you want. That's never going to happen. But I think ideally and hopefully you could slowly weaken Amazon and maybe rebuild communities and businesses that were destroyed by Amazon if people vote with their dollar more. And this kind of thing perhaps influences people to vote with their dollar or spend in an educated fashion. That's my stance. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who wants their little hearts broken? I can do it.
I've got my tissues ready.
Hold on here. Let me see if I can get any confirmation of this next little tidbit I want to run in here. Cause I could just wreck people.
Adam, are you pro Amazon?
Oh, I'm not pro Amazon. I'm pro. I'm pro. If you're gonna protest, then you better take it to its logical conclusion. So, Amazon, most people know them for a couple reasons. Like the one of them being the retail aspect of it, and the other one being Bezos's obscene gross amount of wealth that he has and how that, you know, frequently makes him one of the celebrity billionaires in as part of the conversation about the distribution of wealth and wealth inequality and all that kind of stuff. And that's all great. Amazon has a massive part of their business, and this is the part of the business that they are actually that they're being protested about here, which is Amazon Web Services. Everyone knows it as AWS, which is a huge amount of cloud resources that that kind of give developers building blocks to go make stuff on the internet. It is basically like a place where you put your code and your data and allows it to run to actually make internet happen. And they're not the only one that does that by any means, but the other big ones that do that kind of stuff are all people of, you know, equally problematic actors. You have Google, which has a thing called Google Cloud Services that is a big thing on that front. You have Microsoft, where they have a big service called Azure that's on there. It's basically all these big, massive companies that don't give a shit about really anyone and will gleefully compete for government contracts, including government contracts that probably, you know, ICE will use. So Amazon, in particular, hosts all of the infrastructure that runs Netflix. It hosts all of the infrastructure that runs SoundCloud. I was just trying to figure out if it hosts all of the infrastructure that runs Bandcamp, and I can't figure out that detail while I'm on the podcast at the moment. But if they don't, they definitely, you know, Bandcamp's definitely using one of those guys. And they run all of the infrastructure that runs punknews.org. So,
oh, wow.
So if you want to like, you know, really rage against Amazon and cast them out of your life, then you got to cancel your Netflix account. You got to get the hell off of punknews.org. You have to make sure that you aren't listening to anything on SoundCloud anymore. And probably, I would say a good 60 to 70% of your internet is out the window at that point. Now, I'm not saying that no one should be holding Amazon to account, because, you know, by all means, hold Amazon to account. But this is why when I see like protests like this, you know, it's always, you know, it's more, it's more flash and, you know, flash and sizzle than it is doing anything practical about it. Because, you know, if these artists really, really, really wanted to stick it to Amazon, there's probably a lot of stuff that is in their universe that they have to cancel out and get rid of. And
right, like not selling their actual music.
That's the thing too. It's like,
you know, it's so crazy.
And I'm not even touching on the store, right? Like, can you go to Amazon.com and buy a Downtown Boys record? You probably can, right?
You definitely can. And a Jeff Rosenstock record and a Speedy Ortiz record. Like, all of that stuff is all available on Amazon.
Right. So now that said, should these bands be taking Amazon to task? Like, abso-fucking-lutely. Like, just like rip them apart. But there's one thing about, like, you know, using the platform that you have to speak to the public about these issues and to put public pressure onto Amazon or to Microsoft for that matter to stop doing this stuff, because it was just one of the big things in the news over the past week was that the Pentagon awarded this gigantic contract, like some $10 billion contract to Microsoft instead of Amazon. Specifically, in the news part of this was because, you know, Trump has a hate on for what is the newspaper that Bezos owns? Is it the Washington Post?
Yeah,
right. So he has a hate on for the Washington Post. So he thinks he's gonna, you know, punish Jeff Bezos by meddling in the procurement of the Pentagon, you know, which is problematic in its own right. But in any case, like all these companies are involved in government business at some stripe because that's where the money is. And all of these companies also power most of the internet that you use. So, you know, it's whenever I see something that sounds like it's like a blanket protest or like a, you know, we're going to cut this company out of our life. It's a lot harder than it sounds when it comes to a company that is so fucking massive like this. So, like, were I in the place where people were listening to my opinion, would I be out there advocating everyone stop using Amazon services? I mean, it's kind of unrealistic to do that. I would more be maybe taking the, you know, the Elizabeth Warren track of like, let's break this company up into 500 companies and have them all compete with each other.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, if one of them is then providing services to ICE, it's a lot easier for you to go to one of the, you know, go to one of the baby bells, right? Go to one of the competitions that's been created by that split. I would maybe approach it that way. But, you know, it sucks when you're dealing with giant monopolies that control most of the communications infrastructure. It's really hard to just cut one out of your life.
Well, at least you're doing something. You know what I mean? What's Green Day doing? Green Day's not really doing anything. So at least these bands are.
Green Day would play the theme song for the Amazon company picnic, probably.
So, I mean, at least you're doing something. Like, are they making the absolute best move from some person's subjective opinion? No, but I mean, at least they're doing something, you know, it's what.
Yeah,
know?
I mean, I don't want to begrudge them doing something because, like, Amazon deserves to be taking the task. It's just like, whenever something smacks of like total boycott, like, well, in the internet era, like, there's too many monopolies that total boycott without just, like, you know, joining Integrity and having no internet. Did the guys in Integrity still have no internet, or do they have internet now?
The guys in Integrity? No, I think they've had internet for a while. Maybe you think it's somebody else.
Who am I thinking of? Who's that band? There was some band that was just like, you know, super, super respected DBD.
Oh, Tragedy.
Tragedy. Tragedy. Yeah. They got no internet, right?
I believe they still have no internet. Won't you donate 39 cents a day so that Tragedy can get internet? Moving on. Speaking of somebody that needs cash each day, Morrissey, one of the most divisive men in music right now. He's upset the internet again. And we'll see where I stand at the end of this conversation. Here's how Morrissey got the internet mad this week. This week, Morrissey at his live shows was selling signed records, but the kicker was he was selling signed records of his own records for $200 each, but he was also selling signed records of other people's records for $300 each. Of the other people's records that he was selling was David Bowie's Aladdin Sane, Patti Smith's Horses, Lou Reed's Transformers, and Iggy Pop and the Iggy and the Stooges' Raw Power. Those were $300 each. His greatest Morrissey's greatest hits and Morrissey's covers album were $200 each. And a lot of people thought that was funny or thought that was mad. I've got an opinion. I don't know if you guys want me to kick this off or if you guys want to kick it off and then have me respond.
My thought is it's just like it's just one more hilarious chip into the Morrissey bucket of strangeness. I mean, if all of the Morrissey controversies that we ever had to deal with was him doing something like this, then I would just be delighted because maybe you have the same point. I don't know. Like, it smacks of hilarious egomania, which is something I'm willing to let Morrissey own as long as it's not like egomania that's like rooted in some sketchy end of the political spectrum. But I don't know, what's your read on it, John?
Well, I think we have similar takes in that one of the things that I love about Morrissey is you're never sure if he's being dreadfully serious or he's being hilarious. Like, tellingly, the other people's records are $300 and his records are $200. So I think the joke is, I think the joke is that like he's not actually expecting you to spend $300 on an Iggy Pop record signed by him. So his records are cheaper. So A, it's a bargain, but also he's acknowledging that his records are not as good as Iggy Pop's records or Lou Reed's records. And I believe it's just a hilarious statement. Now, it could be him being dreadfully serious and saying, like, yes, just because I've touched it, it means it's worth $300. I don't think that's what he's saying, but I wouldn't put it past him to be that's what he's saying. And I think that's one of the things that makes it interesting and a mystery. And I think that's one of the reasons why, as an artist, he's great. But here's why I'm annoyed. You know, if this was 18 months ago, before Morrissey really got in the deep end of some whacked out stuff, I'd be in the comment section throwing left and right punches, fighting on behalf of Morrissey. I'd be like, you peons, you knuckleheads, you don't get the genius of Morrissey and how this is hilarious, you know, and how this is an artistic statement. You're a bunch of knuckleheads if you're falling for it, you know. But I can't. I can't because he's been wearing some iffy Def and June style pins. You know what I'm saying, Adam? Def and June style pins. He's been saying some stuff. And so I want to fight on his behalf, but he won't let me, Hallie. He won't let me. You know what I'm saying? I'm waiting for the waters to recede so I can get back in that boat and start swinging again. But as of right now, I'm willing to take some punches on behalf of Morrissey, but I'm not willing to sacrifice myself for Morrissey. You know, and I think that's what he wants. I think he wants people to sacrifice themselves for him.
I have maybe the darkest take on all of this. I don't know why. I saw this and I was like, he must just hate his fans. Like, I almost felt like he was daring them. Like, I almost felt like he was like, let me see how stupid my fans are. Like, he has such contempt. I don't know. I don't know why that was my instinct to just be like, let me see if anyone is actually stupid enough to spend $300 on such a completely idiotic thing. I almost saw like contempt in it. I don't know. But I have very dark feelings about Morrissey these days, as do many of us.
The photo that we posted with this is fascinating for two reasons. The one, well, three now. The one is that the funny one, I guess, is that Morrissey's signature is fucking ridiculous. Like it is the kind of signature that you overthink when you're like trying to come up with your celebrity signature when you're sitting around in grade school. It's silly. There's too many giant swoopy loopy twirls in it. It's a little opulent. The second thing that's amazing here is that if you look closely at the copy of Raw Power and the copy of Transformer that he's selling, he signed it like Morrissey loves Iggy and Morrissey loves Lou. So, you know, acknowledging that a little bit in the signature that these are clearly not his records, and maybe that maybe that shows a little bit of self-awareness of what he's doing here. But the other thing that I can't quite figure out, and no, this must just be part of it. The $200 Best of Morrissey, or the $200
California Sun.
California Sun, is that the name of it? Right. He's like hyphenated 2019, and on the one of them he's written like Hollywood Bowl, and actually on all of the records he has the year written. So for you to be selling a, so okay, so in my mind, selling a best of record that you have signed for $200 is fucking bonkers in any case. So for you to do that, but then to write the venue and the year on it as well, that's pretty presumptuous that someone's going to buy that thing.
Because yeah, if that show.
Yeah. Like if it was just a joke and you were just like dragging these around everywhere to see, like, let's see if we can sell this $300 copy of Raw Power tonight. Right. Like if that was what was going on, that's all right. But like you wrote the venue and the year on it. That's, you know, that, which says to me, someone is probably going to buy that. Or I guess if they don't, they just wasted like, you know, $12 on a thing that'll chuck in the trash, I guess. But I don't know. Like it's a fascinating study. What the hell is going on here? I don't know. Does Morrissey hate his fans though? That is a that's a dark read.
It really is. It was the first thing I thought though.
I like
he was just daring them. Like, I dare you to spend $300 on something so stupid.
Well, Morrissey, a mystery as always, but perhaps the mystery isn't quite as fun as it was 5 to 10 years ago. So let's see here. What else we got to talk about today? Should we play a song or let's? All right, no, let's talk about one. So that's a somewhat punk rock artist that isn't as fun anymore. Let's talk about a punk rock artist that is as fun as they always were, and perhaps are even more fun. And then we'll play a song. The Damned. Last night, The Damned played the Palladium in London, and one of the cool things that they did there is it was the night of 1,000 vampires or the gathering of 1,000 vampires. I forget which. And basically to go to the show, you had to dress up as a vampire. And that was cool. What a lot of people didn't know is that Dave Vanian of The Damned was also going to dress up as a vampire, but not only did he dress up as a vampire, he is in full movie makeup Nosferatu. He looks like Nosferatu, but not only does he look like Nosferatu, he's got the ears, he's got the skull cap on, he's got the contacts in, and he's got the hands. He's got the hands on top of his real hands as Nosferatu. And not only that, they opened the show by covering Bauhaus, Bela Lugosi's Dead, perhaps the most vampire-centric track ever. I thought it was amazing. I wish I went to the show. One of the main questions I had is I wonder if they did a dry run, because Dave Vanian doesn't usually wear full-on makeup at a concert. So I wonder if it's like, oh, I hope I don't overheat in this extremely ornate getup. I thought it was amazing how realistic it looked, but also, perhaps sadly, it's drummer Pinch's last show with the band. He announced about a week ago that he's leaving the band. That it was somewhat of a shock because Pinch has been credited as kind of the guy that got the Damned back on track and did a lot of the behind-the-scenes business organization. Oh, not the past 10 years, but the 10 years before that, when the Damned are really a mess. Pinch is kind of credited as the guy that kind of got the Damned through their most rocky period, if you will, the mid to late 90s. He's leaving the band, and also their bassist also recently left to be replaced by Algie Ward. So is there disharmony in the Damned? Or because he announced that he was leaving about a week before he left the band, it's an amicable part, and he is just not for him to leave the band. So it's bittersweet for the Damned right now. They had perhaps one of the most interesting concerts ever, but Pinch is also leaving the group. Who's to say?
20 years is a pretty decent run, especially in a band where like you're not carrying the pride that you were one of the original members. Like it seems like, especially with a big showcase, you know, kind of final gig like this, it's a respectable place to bow out if you were thinking of bowing out. So I've got to imagine that it was, you know, planned and not a what was wasn't that like Captain Sensible ate his sandwich and he got mad. I don't know why bands actually break up. This is my opinion. It's all about petty food stuff.
Hallie Bullet, what did you think of the Dave Vanian Nosferatu get up?
Completely amazing. It made me more excited for Halloween.
Seriously, I mean, you know, so many of your heroes, or not heroes, but so many bands that you look up to let you down sooner or later. The Damned, I don't think they've ever let anybody down. I mean, they've broken up a million times, but and they put out some mediocre records, but I don't think they've ever let anybody down. They've always been the Damned. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was impressed that they had in sort of like trying to figure out how, because I couldn't remember how long Pinch had been in the band. And so then when I was looking that up, I was like super impressed that they had kept the same lineup. Basically, it seems like for almost 15 years, from like 2004 to 2017. For a band that's been around that long, I sort of feel like, you know, lots of bands get to, by the time they've been around that long, then you get in this thing where it just turns into like, it's either all the original members or it's turned into like a revolving door. So I thought that was like pretty impressive that they had been all those same guys for that huge long stretch of time.
Well, there you have it. Let's play a damn track, and then Adam, if you don't mind, I guess you can play the third song. Let's do something from the Black album, because you know it's kind of the gothy. Let's do Wait for the Blackout. One of my History of the World. One of my favorite Damned songs. This is History of the World by the Damned. And we're already running long because I talked about the Rolling Stones for about 75 minutes, but we got some stories to hit up, a couple more stories to cover. Oh, this is a sad story, unfortunately, and then maybe we'll do some cool stories later on. Rainbow Records is closing after, I think, 80 years. Rainbow Records is operated out of California. for the past 80 years. They've had a couple of different locations, but they're closing up. And the main reason that they're closing up now is simply because they're not able to afford their rent. I guess their CEO has been with them since 1971. I'm waiting for my page to load right now. But basically, the cost of rent is going up. I'll read part of their statement real quick. This is from President Steve Sheldon, who's been with the company since 1971. Dear valued customers, after over a year of trying to negotiate an agreement with our landlord to keep Rainbow on Eaton Street, I'm sorry to say that unfortunately we have been unsuccessful. Our landlord apparently has other plans for this building and has demanded that we vacate the space. It's with incredible sadness that I must announce to you that as of January 31st, 2020, we must be out of the building and Rainbow, after 80 years, will no longer be in business. So they're not taking new orders. This is very sad. Rainbow Records has pressed many of the most iconic records of all time, including Rolling Stones records, including Beatles, including Bob Dylan, including Mötley Crüe, including you, including Clash, including Sex Pistols. They've pressed many, many, many important records and have been after the closure of the RCA pressing plant, Rainbow was the American plant, and now they're closing. I've got a very hot take on this. And an angry take. And I don't know if you guys want me to pop it off or if you guys want to respond first.
I'll go for it.
Listen, I'm just going to call it out. I've been insinuating at this for a couple of years now. I put this fully on the head of Pirates Press. I know everybody loves Pirates Press. I'm anti-Pirates Press. And I'm anti-Pirates Press because they used to be an American pressing plant. And then they shipped all of their gear and all the – well, they got rid of all the employees in the United States. They shipped all of their gear to the Czech Republic, and where labor is much cheaper and, of course, not as protected. And I think the worst part of that is that Pirates Press is the, quote, Oi record label. What's Oi? Oi is the working class punk rock. You know what I mean? And so the, quote, working class punk rock label fired all the American employees and shipped it overseas where labor isn't as protected. But they're still, quote, the Oi label. And when we ran an interview with the guy, I thought it would be the bombshell because we asked him, we said, did you have any second thoughts about shifting it overseas? And I thought his response would be like, well, we thought long and hard about it. And we tried to, his response was, no, it was the greatest decision we ever made. Like he didn't think at all about the ramifications on the American employees or other American pressing plants. And on top of that, he goes throughout the interview, he goes on and on about how Pirates Press, quote, destroys or runs over a quote mom and pop plants. They've got a quicker turnaround and greater pressing capacity. So what I'm saying is Pirates Press directly put Rainbow Records out of business. And you could be cold hearted and say, well, you know, that's business, evolve or die. But at a certain point, maybe pure capitalism, you know, unfettered capitalism isn't the way to go. And I think history, and I'm not socialist, right? I believe in capitalism, but it needs regulations and you need to protect, you know, your own self-interests. And so presses like Pirates Press that ship everything overseas and, you know, and quote, destroy, quote, mom and pop record labels. Well, that's what it is. And so we've lost another American industry because of outsourcing to stuff like that. And it really bumps me out. And I think Rainbow Records is a great and famous plant. And it's sad that that part of history is going away. And Adam, when we be tussling with Pirates Press next, who owns, well, Pirates Press has deep influences on a lot of punk publications. Not us so much, but other ones. And so we'll see. We'll see.
Will we be tussling, or will you, John Gentile, whose opinion is John Gentile's?
I'll fight over this one. I will. I'm not gonna die for Morrissey, but I'll die for Rainbow Records. Well, I won't die for Rainbow Records, but I'll get exiled from the punk scene for Rainbow Records.
I was trying to come up with some sort of funny, I'm going to make you sad and tell you that turns out that punk news killed Rainbow Records, but no, I don't actually have anything. Amazon. I don't know how to get away from you. What else we got, John? Anything else? Anything else we want to talk about?
No comments on Rainbow Records? All right. Fair enough.
No, I don't. You had the knowledge and the outrage. Anything that I add to it is going to be dithering nonsense.
I've had this inside for about ever since Pirates Press kind of came out of nowhere 2 years ago. I've had that feeling festering inside me, and no one seemed to recognize that. Everyone's like, oh, Pirates Press is the greatest. Pirates Press is the greatest. And I guess their product is pretty high quality, but at what cost, you know? And it really bums me out how, like, a company just fired all the American workers and shipped it overseas, you know, for a cheaper product. And not only did that, they made it a point of, they made it central to their business identity that not only are they the biggest and baddest, but they'll, quote, destroy mom and pop companies. And it'd be one thing if they were like, oh, we're Jeff Bezos, you know, we're big and we're bad and we're corporate and we're the best. But they're the, quote, oi record label, the working class record label. It infuriates me. It really does. Anyways, let's talk about a happy story. Penny Rimbaud, tonight, today, he is debuting his new work. Eve Libertine is going to be there doing some vocals as well as some other musicians. His new work is probably – no one knows exactly what it is, but we might know by tomorrow. It's probably a spoken word piece. And, you know, I've been somewhat doom and gloom with podcasts with Amazon and what with Rainbow Records. But on the other hand, we should look at the positive side of life. And how cool is it that Penny Rimbaud, who has been involved with not only the punk scene but the hippie scene – since like 1963, 1964, is still doing his thing. He's still Penny Rimbaud. He still lives at Dial House, and he's still doing challenging, if not accessible, but challenging and, well, sometimes interesting, but always daring, difficult, but perhaps rewarding art. He's still doing his thing. He's never not been Penny Rimbaud, and he's still doing it 100%. The new work is called And He Was Cut Down, and it's described as a retake of the Tale of the Calvary. And it's live in London right now at the Jazz Club for a measly £10, so cheap enough. Hopefully he'll come back to the USA. He comes here about once every 10 years for a couple of limited engagements, so I'm hoping he does again. We'll see. He's pretty old. I mean, he's about 76, 77 at this point. But listen, Penny Rimbaud, man, he walks the walk. If you watch the Crash documentary, you see him taking a dump in compost toilet. So he's walking the walk. You know what I mean? Like you don't do that on film unless you're the real deal. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I agree with you, but I didn't know what the... I don't know how to lead off of that. Anything, John? Do you want to talk about how you're outraged? Like nobody seems to comment on any of these Crass related stories?
Yeah, I've made this argument a million times before, but every, you know, we'll post about like Tegan and Sarah, which are fantastic, and people are like, I thought this was punk news, not pop news, and we'll get like 45 comments on Tegan and Sarah about how Tegan and Sarah are punk, or some reviewer will review U2 and say U2 was my gateway into punk just because I kind of got into alternative music that way, and then we'll have 45 people saying U2's not punk, I hate U2. I don't care about U2 either, but I mean, that's fine. That's fine if you think that's not punk. But then how come when we post about things that are undisputably punk, Penny Rimbaud doesn't get punk in the Penny Rimbaud, or The Damned with Dave Vaney dressed up as Nosferatu, it's crickets. So you're not really complaining about that it's not punk. You just want to whine. And I've made this argument before. And so the point being is I will not hear any criticism that such and such is not punk until the actual punk stuff is overflowing with comments.
There is literally not one comment on this article. My take is the same as with all this stuff. I love when people keep making art. I think it's amazing. I don't know what I would think about this new work of his. I mean, I'm just looking at this picture. It's like he's old. I fucking love when old people keep doing shit and don't just disappear. And I hate like society's expectation that people will just kind of disappear, that they're not going to have anything relevant to say anymore. I love when people just like refuse to fucking go out like that, you know, and they just like keep having something to say and putting it out there, regardless of whether the people on punknews.com are going to comment on the article or not, you know?
Well put and well said. Hallie, one last article perhaps of things that are challenging to people. Very divisive record. Band-Aid Brigade, they've released a new single. It's called Break the Grid. Band-Aid Brigade is Brian Wallstrom of Gods of Mount Olympus and Zach of Pears, and it is dramatically different, wildly different than Pears. It's more, I guess, popish, perhaps Hall and Oates. Hallie, what did you think of Break the Grid, the new single by Band-Aid Brigade?
So super fun and like unexpected. Like I've seen Pear. I saw Pear at Fest, and that I was so like delighted and shocked at how poppy this was. But I love pop music, so it's, you know, it's gonna appeal to me maybe more than other punk fans.
Do you think that we always must consider something in the let's use Screaming Females as an example. Let's say Screaming Females come out with a straight up pop record. We're talking pop in the, you know, the modern Gwen Stefani sense, the Madonna sense, the Rihanna sense. If they come out with that, should we view that through a punk lens, or should we just say this is pop and is it good or not on its own merits? Like, does a punk artist need to always be chained to punk, if you will?
No, I think that's like what makes punk terrible sometimes.
Ah.
It's like when people just refuse to, like, I don't know, like refuse to. I don't know. I have a lot of opinions about this, and we've gone long already. and I spent too long talking about apples, and now I can't talk about this for as long as I want to. But like, I feel like when I, like, there were just decades where, like, all I listened to was punk, and I just listened to nothing else, and it was so limiting, and I regret those years, and my palate is a lot broader now. I think it just makes me a better music listener, a better music appreciator, and then when I'm listening to punk, I feel like I have, like, I just have a bigger, wider music brain that I'm listening to my punk with, and I have absolutely no problem with when artists want to do something that's not punk. I find it terribly, terribly refreshing. I find it a relief almost, actually. To, you know, life is too freaking short to just be like limited to one genre of music. Music is so big and crazy and beautiful and sprawling. And like, why not just like and listen to and make like anything you want? I don't know. Whatever. Peace and love.
Hallie, well said indeed. I think we'll have to wrap the episode up on that because I don't think anyone can follow that. Adam, what did you want to play a track and then we'll shut it on down, or what do you want to do?
Yeah, all right, sure. And I agree 100% with the statement that Hallie just said there. So I don't want to add anything to it. So here we go. This is a track from the new Ancient Shapes record. This is the Daniel Romano led kind of power pop supergroup that runs concurrently with his kind of like weirdo alt country solo career. So the new record that they put out is called A Flower That Wouldn't Bloom. It's out on You've Changed Records. I'm gonna play a song called Welland 2020. This has been like a surreal song to enter my life because Danny was a member of a pop punk band called Attack in Black that was popular 10 years ago or something like that. So they're all from Welland, Ontario, which is a town that is about a 20-minute drive from where I live in Niagara Falls. It's where my wife's from. It's where all my in-laws live. It is a just town that has been crushed by leaving industry and you know, all that kind of normal rust belt malaise that affects, you know, all sorts of towns along the Great Lakes here. And Danny doesn't talk a lot about Niagara in his music, but whenever he does, it's super delightful. And Welland 2020 is just this like this rallying cry about how like next year is going to be the year of Welland, which if you've ever been there, seems pretty inexplicable because it's pretty fucking beat up. And they put out a music video that goes with this song that's just these tiny 2-second clips of all these dilapidated buildings around the town. But at the same point, there's like clips of these like beloved hole-in-the-wall restaurants that are around the city, and you can kind of get the optimism in it. And I went and I posted this to Facebook the other day and just hashtagged it Welland 2020. And my mother-in-law, who never comments at all on any of my music nonsense because like she just has no reason to engage with it, she popped in and just said like, "Hope he's right." I'm like, "All right." I mean, like you live there, so if you can if that's the reaction from the born and bred Wellander is like, then I guess that's all right then. So here we go. So this is Welland 2020 by Ancient Shapes. And if anyone wants to send us email, it is podcast@punknews.org, and that's how you do it. See you later. Welland 2020, that's something I can really dig. Welland 2020.